Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and Bernie is out. The race for the Democratic presidential nomination is essentially over. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders delivered the message to supporters earlier today that he is suspending his presidential campaign.
While we are winning the ideological battle, and while we are winning the support of so many young people and working people throughout the country, I have concluded that this battle for the Democratic nomination will not be successful.
So that makes former Vice President Joe Biden the presumptive Democratic nominee. WBUR's Anthony Brooks joins us on the line to help us break it all down. Welcome back, Anthony.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Anthony, you're our senior political reporter. You've done a ton of politics coverage, including Sanders in 2016 and 2020. What are your initial reactions here?
Well, I guess not surprised at this point. I mean, we weren't exactly sure when this announcement was going to come, but in effect, there was no way for Sanders to win the nomination. He was 300 or so delegates behind. For him to prevail, he would have to win all the remaining primaries by 60% of the vote, and that just wasn't going to happen, and he recognized that. So then it became a sort of tactical decision. When did it make sense to drop out? You'll recall in 2015, he sort of took his race all the way to the convention, essentially, before he backed Hillary Clinton. I think he recognized a couple of things. He said in his announcement today that with the pandemic, this is not a good time to be campaigning. The country has to focus on other stuff. So I think he was aware of that. And I also think there's not the kind of bad blood there was between him and Hillary Clinton in 2015, between him and Joe Biden. And that he wants to do what he can to get the Democratic Party to coalesce around the presumptive Democratic candidate, who's now Joe Biden, to give him the best chance of beating Donald Trump. So I think for all those reasons, he made that decision to drop out today.
So, Anthony, I was thinking just before we started talking that this is the first time I can remember in a long time that the thing we started our show with wasn't about the coronavirus pandemic. But I also find myself wondering, the moment that we're in clearly must have affected how this race played out, the timing of various decisions. I mean, those lines in Wisconsin yesterday with people with face masks on showing up for the primary. What does this mean for the race in the age of coronavirus?
Well, I mean, I think the coronavirus had a lot to do with his decision. Sanders was actually horrified by the decision of election officials, of Republicans essentially in Wisconsin, to go forward with that vote. And he actually said toward the end that he wasn't going to campaign out there in any way that he could campaign. I mean, it was all sort of online campaigning anyway. And I think that played a big part of this decision today. You know, I think if we weren't dealing with an epidemic right now, Sanders might have thought differently. He would still be able to have those rallies. He would still be able to rally his supporters and move them toward the convention and, leverage his influence a little bit more on Joe Biden and so forth. But I think, you know, in this age of the pandemic, that would have just been irresponsible to do that. And I think he recognized that. So I think that has a big part of that. That played a big part of the decision.
Anthony, we've got a couple of calls I'd like to go to. And let me just throw the number out for listeners. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Donovan's on the line from Natick. Donovan, go ahead.
I call. I just wanted to talk a little bit about, and this is more of a statement than a question, but I wanted to talk about a good group of the progressive left that is basically saying never Biden. They're Bernie till the end, and they will either abstain or vote for Trump. And I think that as a progressive group, we need to kind of stop being inebriated by Bernie's idealism and come to embrace Biden's realism here. And we need to start transitioning into this point of unity where we all back Biden, because he certainly is, at least for Democrats, the best choice. And,
Donovan,
thank you.
Thanks for that. Let's add T now from Canton. T, go ahead.
Yes, very disappointed that Bernie dropped out. I realize he had no choice, But the fact is that NPR, as well as the entire Democratic establishment, fought against him. And it's very easy. I know in these past couple of days, you've been talking about the disparity in death rates among different groups. It's very easy to talk about race than the underlying conditions that affect poor people of all races. So you continue to talk about race, and you know, nothing will be done to help poor people who are suffering, among others, in this epidemic.
So, T, thanks for that.
That's all I wanted to say.
I appreciate that. So we've got two sides there, Anthony. I want to pick two things up out of that. One, somebody clearly saying it is time to coalesce behind Biden. Someone saying people were not prepared to support Sanders. And also criticism you've said you've heard on the trail and raised before, that you know, that Sanders supporters often say, which is that the media did not give him a fair shake, and as a result, the people he's trying to represent didn't get a fair shake.
Yeah, a lot in there. I mean, in terms of the first caller, I mean, I think it's a good point. And you know, I'd point out that Bernie Sanders himself, one of the first things he'd say at all of his rallies was that he hopes he wins, but that if he doesn't win the nomination, he's going to do everything he can to convince Democrats to coalesce around whoever does win to defeat Donald Trump. And he has been very, very consistent in that message. In terms of him being opposed by the establishment, I mean, I think we have to be careful about what we mean by the establishment. If you mean he's been opposed by centrist Democrats, well, it's true. I mean, look, Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg dropped out. They threw their weight behind Joe Biden. Beto O'Rourke followed. Michael Bloomberg followed. A whole bunch of folks followed. So there is the Democratic establishment clearly lining up behind Joe Biden. But I would also point out that we learned that a majority of voters within the Democratic Party also were part of that, favored that part of the Democratic establishment. And that, in the end of the day, was Bernie Sanders' biggest challenge, that his hope to grow that progressive movement, to get all those young people and to be a viable candidate within the Democratic Party didn't pan out. And I'm not sure I buy that that was entirely because the, you know, this evil establishment lined up against him. It's just not where most voters were. Even as lots of voters embraced many of his policies. And Bernie Sanders can be proud of the fact, you know, that a lot of the issues that were considered outside the mainstream in 2015 are now inside the mainstream.
Yeah, Anthony, I mean, I'd like to play a little sound from Sanders about that today real quick.
Sure.
While this campaign is coming to an end, our movement is not. I will stay on the ballot in all remaining states and continue to gather delegates. While Vice President Biden will be the nominee, we must continue working to assemble as many delegates as possible at the Democratic Convention, where we will be able to exert significant influence over the party platform and other functions.
Consistent with what you were saying.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's consistent with what I was saying and consistent with what Sanders has been saying all along. And one of the points I'd add, you know, he talked about winning the ideological battle, even though he can't win the nomination, that his movement has won the ideological battle. I think that's true to a point. And by that, I mean this. There are a lot of issues that were considered outside of the mainstream. A $15 minimum wage back in 2015. Now it's part of the Democratic mainstream. You know, getting serious about economic inequality is now part of the conversation. You know, although Medicare for All wasn't embraced by everybody, everyone had a version of it and was talking about it as something that we really have to focus on. Pete Buttigieg had Medicare for All who wanted. Joe Biden's talking about a public option. Elizabeth Warren embraced Medicare for All. So this has really become part of the Democratic conversation. Where I'm a little skeptical about the idea that they've sort of won the ideological battle is Sanders showed that he can raise tens of millions of dollars from small donors and go around the big sort of corporatist wing of the Democratic Party. But I'm not convinced that that wing of the Democratic Party is going away. In other words, you know, old-fashioned, big style fundraising money, the corporatist wing, pay-to-play politics. I'm afraid that's all still there and very much part of the Democratic Party moving forward. So that's a battle Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, for that matter, was unable to win, although they put the issue on the table in big ways.
So in our last 30 seconds or so, where does his movement and where do his supporters go from here?
Well, that's a good question. And I think you heard the span in those two callers.
Yeah.
I mean, my sense is talking to voters. Yes, I think there's going to be a core of Sanders supporters who will stay home, who are just disgusted that he didn't do it again. But I think, you know, this is a different time than 4 years ago. Donald Trump will have been president for 4 years by the time people go to the polls. I think that will have a certain power of convincing a lot of folks to leave some of their ideological purity at home and go to the polls and vote for the Democrat.
WBUR's Anthony Brooks, thanks.
Sure, my pleasure.
A little later this hour, we'll bring you live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing, as we do every day here at Radio Boston and WBUR. He's expected shortly after 3:30. These daily gubernatorial briefings have become a staple of Massachusetts life. So have those by our neighbor, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, whose updates are watched across the country, and those from President Donald Trump and the Federal Coronavirus Task Force. Listening to our elected officials daily, we got to thinking about approaches to leadership in a time of crisis. We want to know, what do you think? What do you think we need most from our leaders now, and who is inspiring you as a leader during this pandemic? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And David Gergen joins us on the line for this conversation. He was an advisor to four U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's also the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. David, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. It's good to talk to you again.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm better listening to you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm so psyched for this conversation. I've had like 800 questions in my head for you for a while now. I want to start with Bernie Sanders, because we just heard from political reporter Anthony Brooks on him dropping out of the presidential race today.
Yes.
What's your reaction?
I think Bernie Sanders deserves credit for being a very responsible player within the Democratic Party. I'm sure it was not easy for him to give up the fight, but he did it graciously, and I think he did it in a timely fashion, especially given, as you just were talking about, the environment, the context of the pandemic. Having said that, I think that there is a major question still ahead. And that is, Bernie Sanders has now dropped out, but is he going to be as forceful an advocate for Joe Biden and try to bring the party together to unify the Democratic Party? Or is he going to hold out for concessions at the convention and possibly even on the question of the running mate as a price for his enthusiastic support? I thought he would go down the former route as I first started listening to him today, but you just had a clip on with him saying that he wants to continue collecting delegates so that he'll have more leverage at the convention. That sent a sort of a chill up, I think, the backs of some Democrats. If that's really going to be the game, that could be quite divisive.
Well, I did notice also, David, he very clearly did not endorse Joe Biden today.
Exactly. Exactly. And I trusted he will. I mean, as your reporter said, he has promised many times that he would support whoever the nominee is. So I trust he will give the endorsement. But if it's a grudging endorsement or if it's an enthusiastic endorsement, matters. You just ask the Hillary folks, who still bear a lot of grudges, that they felt he just simply didn't show up for them and didn't fire up his voters in the last time around. And there are many of them who think they would have won the election had he done that. So we're not. They're not there yet, but I think it's an important step forward for Joe Biden. Biden has got his own issues right now in this environment. It's hard for him to have a voice in the midst of this pandemic. It's hard for him to be heard. There was an interesting poll that came out today that showed who would do a better job managing this crisis, this pandemic, Trump or Obama. And a majority of the people went for Obama. They then asked a question about who would you prefer managing the crisis, Trump versus Biden. Trump came out on top. That was a surprise to me.
So let's use that as our chance to pivot here, because that means that people have mental models about what good leadership in a crisis is.
Exactly.
What would you say is the right sort of mental model, or the one that you have about what leadership in a crisis, good leadership in a crisis, should look like?
Well, I think it's very, very important. One of the lessons from Vietnam was that first commit the country and then commit the troops. One of the first things that a president in crisis has to do is to rally people to his side or to her side. And you do that, I think, by a lot of straight talk, not happy talk, which is what typified Trump's approach here in the months of February and March. There was a lot of happy talk. We've got this under control. There are only 15 cases. It'll be down to one soon, et cetera, et cetera. And there was very little straight talk. What are the standards historically? Well, I've spent time recently with Harvard historian Nancy Kane, who also is a good friend. And she made the argument and offered two different phrases, which I like very much. She said a president in times of crisis ought to offer first brutal realism, and ought to combine that with credible hope. And I think that's exactly right.
So, David, what's playing in my head as you're speaking is I'm thinking back to the famous Jimmy Carter speech in The Cardigan, which certainly did the brutal realism part. But I think the conventional wisdom is that sunk him and was a bad moment of leadership as a president.
Well, a lot depends on how you phrase these things. Jimmy Carter was not exactly a president seen who didn't strike most people as muscular. And Jimmy Carter was a great saint, but may have been in the wrong job in the White House. I think a much better example and cleaner one for this purpose is the way that Franklin Roosevelt mobilized the country behind the World War II effort. He realized the country was still very isolationist as war approached. He had to do it carefully, but he carefully built up his case, and then he called for early on, before we got too deeply into this, called for America to become the arsenal of democracy. That was going to be one of our great contributions. And in particular, America at that point had a very, very weak, small army. We were weaker than Portugal in terms of our army. And we were producing very small number of planes at that point, about 5,000 a year, maybe 6,000 a year. Roosevelt went to the experts and said, well, how many planes could we build a year if we really put our hearts into it? And they said 25,000. And he said, well, that sounds great. It'd be hard to do, but it's simply not enough. And he went out and proclaimed a goal of 50,000 planes a year. And people scoffed at them. Experts scoffed, but he said, you don't understand what Americans can do once they're into the game and they're fully mobilized. And by the end of the war, we were not producing 50,000 planes a year. We were producing 75,000 planes a year. And the Ford Motor Company had a place called Willow Run, where they converted all their auto manufacturing into airplane manufacturing. There was one bomber coming off the production lines. One bomber, a big plane, coming off the production lines on the average of one a minute.
Let's grab a little sound. This is actually Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the Day of Infamy speech to Congress the day after the Japanese attacks on Pearl Harbor.
These acts of mass murder were intended to frighten our nation.
So that was George W. Bush.
That all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
So, David, you talked about, the way that Roosevelt pushed us in our production.
Yes.
We talked about Jimmy Carter. We hear that here often. There seems to be an association with great oration and great leadership. Is that true? And if so, why?
I think it is basically true. Major moments in history call forth people who can speak well. And I think that you, as a general, it's not uniformly true. But if you look at the great presidents, the three greatest presidents in the minds of historians in American history were Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt. Of those two, Lincoln and Roosevelt both were among the best orators of their centuries. You think what we salute in literature, Henry V at Agincourt, you know, that wonderful speech about we band of brothers. You think about Pericles to the Athenian soldiers. There, if you look at the history of oratory, you do find that in more cases than you might imagine, the quality and capacity of a leader to arouse the public behind him is before committing, you know, the troops, so to speak, before committing to the society to a major, major battle. It prepares people mentally, psychologically for and they're willing to sacrifice. They're not willing to sacrifice if they don't think you're serious. One of the things about Donald Trump is he's been so complacent at times and so contradictory at times that people don't know how much they can trust him and they can trust his word. I think in that, you know, frankly, you know, they've said this is going to be the week of Pearl Harbor. Well, they downgraded that like yesterday, but nonetheless, the administration has been saying the next 10 days are going to be really, really critical, the high point of the whole thing. I think when these 10 days are over, it's really imperative that the president himself go to the country, maybe in a joint session, maybe in the Oval Office, but to talk us through what lies ahead beyond this initial period, because it appears that we're not going to be able to just, you know, lift all these restrictions and merrily go back to work. It's going to be a long, hard period ahead, and whether he can, I think it's up to Trump to try to hold us together to make that march together.
I'd like to grab a call here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sally is on the line from Watertown. Hi, Sally. What's on your mind?
Hi. I reject the whole idea, actually, of leadership the way you're talking about it.
How come?
Well, because they're politicians. We elected them. We put them in office. They're our employees. And when they don't do what's best for the public, I don't really care what they're saying. I care what they do.
And so what do you think the answer then is? It feels like there's a second part to that, Sally. So we've elected them. If we don't like what they do, then what?
We fire them.
And that's through the polls. Is that right?
Well, that's the only way we have right now.
All right. Let's take it back to David Gergen. And I want to give you a heads up and listeners. We are anticipating, I know, David, you know this, Governor Charlie Baker's
yes.
press briefing. So if I rudely
sure.
go to him, let me apologize to you.
No, please do. So, I will all want to hear what he has to say.
Excellent. What's your reaction to Sally's call?
Well, look, it is. They are all politicians, and we do elect them, and we have a chance. The polls are not going to stop Donald Trump. I don't care if he dropped to 25%. He's still going to be president. He's going to do what he always does. What is important is the election in November. That's critical. That's when the American people have a chance to say yay or nay. They can, and frankly, right now, I don't think we know which way this is going to go. We're in very, very uncertain times. But I do think in order to get big things done, you have to use the bully pulpit, going all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt, to mobilize people behind you. The worst thing you can do as a leader is to step out in front, look over your shoulder, and realize nobody's following.
So
if they're not following, you're not going to succeed.
In preparing for the conversation with you today, David, I found myself thinking that all the examples I was thinking about have to do with a human enemy who came onto American soil.
Yes.
We are in a very different situation here.
I agree. So I agree.
How do we process that?
Well, I think the president keeps on talking about it as a invisible enemy, almost a sinister invisible enemy that's sneaking into our bedrooms and sneaking into our streets, and that you have to be fearful. I think you can overdo that.
It is kind of scary, and it does feel invisible.
It is kind of scary, but that's where the question of credible hope comes in. You can't lose sight of the fact that we're going to make it through. The question is, are we going to make it through with a minimal loss of life, or are we going to make it through with a massive loss of life? And that is a presidential responsibility, to try to minimize the number of deaths. I don't think we know which way it's going to come out yet. The numbers right now are very scary. Listen, we have a daughter who's working at the Boston Medical Center, and she, you know, she's been there on the front lines today. And, you know, I'm just, you know, you can imagine how many people are concerned. and frightened and on edge, because this strikes into so many families in the Boston area and across the country.
David, you got me in my gut there. I'll be thinking about her and hoping for her safety.
Okay. You're kind. Thank you.
Let me ask you, is there a leader out there right now, an elected leader, local level, state level, federal level, who you think is manifesting or embodying what's important right now in a time of crisis like
sure.
this?
Sure. Well, in terms of the bluntness, the candor, as well as the hope, I do think that Governor Cuomo of New York is right at the top. He's come into his own with this. He was not a particularly popular governor before because he's tough-minded. But now he's exactly what we need in this context. One recalls that in the late 30s or early 1940s, that Winston Churchill, who was out to pasture and nobody thought he'd ever come back into office because he was seen as reckless and headstrong, when the Nazis started moving, you know, and they needed a new prime minister, they turned to Churchill because he was tough and he understood the threat. And Cuomo was acting as if he does, having his brother, you know, stricken with the coronavirus is only, I think, emphasized that. I do think Charlie Baker has become one of the, if you could, on any list of the top five governors in the country, you have to put Charlie Baker on that list.
Which characteristics make you put him on that list?
I think the remarkable capacity he has had to keep people at a time of sharp polarization, to create majorities that are bipartisan to get things done, you know, I think he's been honest with us, which is really important. We miss honesty in our politics today. There's something about him that we'll get it down. There's something about him that's calming, I think, to people. I believe this governor of Washington State, Jay Inslee, has been first rate. The president's gone after him, I think, totally inappropriately. Gavin Newsom is coming on. I do think there are more women out there. The woman who's Whitmer, who is governor of Michigan,
Gretchen Whitmer. Yeah.
Yes. I think she's really been she's become a dark horse now for potentially being on the vice presidential nominee of the Democratic Party. We'll see. But in this past several months, even before this virus broke out, but she's been good on the virus. She's been well-spoken. She's been understanding, but she's been very persistent in trying to protect the good people of her state.
We're talking to David Gergen, former advisor to four U.S. presidents. To join the conversation, it's 1-800-423-8255. And just to note that we are awaiting a press conference soon from Governor Charlie Baker. Let's take another call. We've got David on the line from Auburndale.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am just always thinking about what we need from a president now is to be sort of bigger than themselves, like to look beyond themselves with empathy towards being kind and big solutions. And I just don't think Trump has that capacity. He looks at the world through a mirror, and the first thing he always sees is himself, and he just never fails to cast everything as a reflection on himself. And I feel like he just lacks the empathy quality that we need to someone who can call up our collective kindness and to rally us to something that's bigger than ourselves. He's just concerned about himself primarily. He never fails to disappoint.
Thanks for that, David. I appreciate it. And David Gergen, as we hear David from Auburndale, of course, what else is running through my head is that the president's approval ratings recently have actually been very high. So how do we square the circle between what we're hearing from David in Auburndale and Trump supporters who are feeling very motivated by the way the president is behaving in this crisis?
Well, it is true, Tiziana. I have to take I'm not sure I agree totally on the numbers. Let me just say when this first broke, his numbers did go up. He got up 57% of the approval on the way he was handling things. And in the last couple of weeks, that's fallen. He's gone from about 57 down to around 45. His overall approval has been steady at around 44. But I think early on, there was a rally around the president bump that he got. That happens with presidents when they get into a conflict. The initial tendency of the American people, and thank goodness, is to try to support in a patriotic way whatever the president decides, and especially sending soldiers into harm's way. So he got a bump. He got about a 5, 6, 7 point bump. By past standards, that's actually modest. When George W. Bush, just after 9/11, he got a 35% boost in his ratings. And George H.W. Bush, after he went into Kuwait, he got a double-digit boost in his ratings. And so the one that Trump has gotten is small. I don't mean to get too into the weeds on polls. But
I'm a numbers geek. I like polls. You go right ahead.
Overall, I would think you'd have to say that the jury is still out. Nobody knows how this is going to quite end up. He has started these press briefings, as you know so well.
Yes.
They go on and on and on. And he's obviously enjoys them. He obviously thinks they're benefiting his role as commander-in-chief. He's pushing them later and later into as close to prime time as he can. He's got them up to around 6 o'clock.
And you think that's on purpose?
You bet.
Sorry, that was almost a stupid question, but you weren't going to say it, but I will.
You're allowed rhetorical questions at the end. You know that. But I have to tell you, I think that these appearances now are starting to frighten people. True, not his base, but you talk to people in New York who are sort of listening to this, you know, and they get worried about it. They get worried about his, where he is. They think he's not empathic, but he doesn't understand the needs of the poor and the near poor who are going through hell right now with this situation. And you know, so it's one of the first times I've seen, to the end of the public ratings, he gets strengthened the way he did. And yet his ratings among professionals, whether they be, you know, they be in the health industry or they're hospitals or the lawyers or whoever you may want to, or the pundit, the commentariat, they've all gone south. He's gone north with a lot of his supporters, but he's gone south with the rest of the country. It's a real split.
So, David, we've had like a 1 minute warning from Governor Baker.
Sure.
I'd love to sneak in from you one message of hope from David Gergen to our listeners.
Oh, we're going to get through this and we're going to come together more than we have right now. It's going to be a longer struggle than we thought. I think there's going to be a lot of pain going forward, but I'm increasingly confident we're going to come through it. And I hope that we can find new ways of living together when it's over. We certainly need that.
And what will you be watching for as the curve flattens out and we begin to need some decisions about what happens next, how we crawl our way back out of this?
I don't know. I just hope that we don't ask our people who are our doctors and nurses to make a lot of decisions about who's going to live and who's going to die. Those are very, very hard calls. They ought to be made by the families and so far as possible. But increasingly with the continuing shortage of equipment, but just the way the number of people are coming through the doors, they're going to be, next few days are going to be very, very tough.
David, I want to. Oh no!
Yeah, go please.
No, you go ahead. The longer I can
keep
you, the better.
Stick together, guys. We're going to make it.
I want to thank David Gergen, an advisor to four U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. And now we go to Governor Charlie Baker live for his daily briefing at the State House.
On the testing front, as of yesterday, we've tested a total of 81,344 individuals. And yesterday alone, we conducted 4,900 tests. Just a few weeks ago, we set a goal of 3,500 tests a day, and we've been exceeding it pretty much every day since. Thanks to a lot of hard work, we continue to perform at a level above where we anticipated, and we're one of the top testers in the country on a per capita basis. We're continuing to explore new testing sites, and we'll have a new mobile testing site at the Big E Fairgrounds in West Springfield shortly. It will supplement a site at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough that launched earlier this week. These are mobile testing sites, and each will perform about 200 tests a day by appointment for first responders and other emergency management workers. It's good progress on testing. As we continue to see an increase in tests, obviously, we've also seen an increase in the number of confirmed cases. We're up to about 15,202 cases here in Massachusetts, with 1,365 new cases being reported yesterday. As we've said before, Through extensive modeling with our command center's medical advisory committee and public health experts, we expect to see a surge in cases that could potentially peak sometime between April 10th and April 20th. We're continually reviewing the modeling, but right now we see evidence that we're still on the upward slope of this pandemic. For example, the average new positive tests in Massachusetts has been rising steadily for 3 weeks. The percent of people testing positive continues to rise and reached a new high on Monday, where about 30% of all tests conducted were positive, and remained high on Tuesday, where about 28% of all tests conducted were positive. And obviously, we have, unfortunately, seen continued fatalities associated with this virus. At the same time, we've not seen the same steep acceleration seen in either Wuhan, New York, or other places, which means we're cautiously optimistic that our social distancing, essential services orders, and other measures that we and others have put in place are helping to flatten the curve. These remain, and I'll say it again, our most effective weapons to contain the disease, and we're grateful to all of the Commonwealth's residents for doing their part by following them. But as I said before, this is not a time to get complacent. In fact, it means the opposite. We are entering a period of time where we could be putting serious strain on our healthcare system and our hospitals. So everyone needs to continue to hold up their end of the deal. Stay home, wash your hands, use hand sanitizer, wipe surfaces, clean off commonly used elements like doorknobs, and stand at least 6 feet apart and wear a mask or cover your face if you have to go out. And this isn't just about protecting yourself. Continue to remember that. It's also about protecting the people who need the most protection, other people, older people, and those with health conditions. We're also taking additional action today to further protect our healthcare workers and our healthcare providers. Federal and state law provide certain protections for healthcare workers and especially volunteers against lawsuits and civil liability. But during this pandemic, we're in unprecedented times where our providers may be forced to make difficult choices, and we're asking them to operate in conditions that they've never planned for. We need to make sure that fear of getting sued doesn't prevent them from being able to do what they need to do to treat as many people as possible. First, I'm issuing a directive that will maximize protections for healthcare workers and healthcare facilities under the Federal Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act, or the PREP Act. The Federal PREP Act on its own provides significant protections for our healthcare workers. The directive that I'm issuing will ensure that healthcare workers and facilities that distribute and administer testing, drugs, and medical devices for this diagnostic and for the diagnosis and treatment of COVID-19 are protected from lawsuits and liability to the maximum extent possible under the PREP Act. But the PREP Act does not cover all the situations our healthcare workforce may encounter and needs to be protected from during this particular pandemic. Because it's limited in some ways to certain aspects of the COVID-19 response, it doesn't cover everything we believe needs to be covered. That's why we worked with the Attorney General's office, with many folks in the healthcare advocacy and ethical community, with hospitals and the Mass Medical Society, to create additional protections in the bill that we filed earlier today. The legislation would protect healthcare professionals, including doctors, nurses, and EMTs, as well as healthcare facilities, from liability and lawsuits when the care they provide is impacted by the COVID-19 emergency. It would also provide liability protections for the organizations that have generously made their facilities available for the Commonwealth and for many of our providers to use in response to this pandemic. We speak with leaders and doctors from Massachusetts hospitals and healthcare organizations just about every morning, and they are stepping up in a big way during this crisis. And this bill will make sure that they are free to do their jobs the best they can in this unprecedented situation. And again, I want to thank the Attorney General, Maureen Healey, and her team for their help in crafting this legislation, and we urge the legislature to move quickly on this bill. I also want to touch on the emergency guidelines the Department of Public Health put together for medical providers in preparation for the surge in cases we are expecting. As in any large-scale crisis situation, a larger number of patients can stress hospital staff, equipment, and supplies to the breaking point. It's hard to believe that we're in a period where hospitals might have to make difficult decisions about how to distribute resources like ventilators, but that's the worst-case scenario, and we must plan for it. While we're doing everything we can to ensure that we have all the resources we need, we must also plan for the possibility that the virus hits too many people in too short a period of time. In the worst case scenario, our Department of Public Health jointly developed guidelines for hospitals in conjunction with ethicists, public health experts, and medical professionals to ensure that no one's background, social standing, or disability is ever considered if such a decision has to be made. These are not conversations that anybody ever wants to have. But over the past few weeks, we heard from many within the healthcare community on the need to issue recommendations on how to equitably and ethically allocate healthcare resources across the system. In these unprecedented times, every state and many individual hospitals are coming up with what are called crisis standards of care. And today, Massachusetts is releasing its recommendations. They are, in fact, just recommendations. They're not mandatory. But we have a moral obligation to ensure that there are transparent and ethical guidelines available to our medical professionals if they have to make these excruciating decisions. These guidelines are based on work that was originally produced by the University of Pittsburgh and has been adopted by many other states along similar guidelines. And they're designed to ensure consistent decision-making and to protect patients' fair access to healthcare services. We expect the guidelines would only be used in true disaster situations, and of course, we're doing everything in our power to prevent these situations from occurring in the first place. However, we owe it to our residents, our frontline healthcare providers, our hospitals, and our citizens to help them through this public health emergency. As the Lieutenant Governor mentioned yesterday, we put additional guidance out to ensure the safety of our grocery stores for both employees and customers. Yesterday, we issued new orders that require stores to limit store occupancy to 40% of its regular level. This is in addition to an order we put out 2 weeks ago to increase access to hand sanitizer and hand washing facilities and enforce social distancing policies, including marked social distancing lines beginning 6 feet away from all checkout counters. The Commonwealth's grocery store workers are doing a terrific job, and they are on the front lines every day, serving customers and making sure our residents have the food they need to feed themselves and their families. This critical work does not go unnoticed, and on behalf of the Commonwealth, I want to say thank you for all of the work that you do every day during this crisis. You're spending long hours away from home and away from your loved ones to make sure that others have the essential items that they need. And we value your service and will continue to take any necessary steps, working with local communities, local boards of health, our Department of Public Health, and others, to ensure that your safety is taken seriously and put at the top of the pile as you conduct your jobs. We also would like to remind customers that they need to follow the social distancing protocols that exist within stores to keep these workers and themselves safe. As I've said before, and we've said many times, the best thing you can do to protect our essential workers is to stay home unless you absolutely, positively have to be out. Continue to practice social distancing and do what you can to help us flatten the curve. As we approach this surge, it's especially critical that everyone follow the measures we've put into place and limit your exposure to others. Everyone's got a role to play here, and in the weeks ahead, it will be even more important that everyone take that role seriously. Thank you. With that, I'll turn it over to Secretary Sutters.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Governor, Lieutenant Governor. I have a couple of brief updates from the command center on our nursing home program and reporting on testing. So as you know, the mobile testing program that was launched last week has provided, as of yesterday, on-site testing for 103 long-term care facilities, providing more than 1,600 tests. Today, they're visiting 23 sites to conduct more than 300 tests. The program was started primarily in nursing homes because that is where some of the most significant outbreaks have been, and they are medically based facilities. Yesterday, we also responded to more than 150 calls to our new nursing home family resource line, a dedicated phone line to connect family members of nursing home and rest home residents with the information and resources they need. It's important during these times to provide as much information to families who can't visit their loved ones. The new phone line provides one central contact for anyone who has questions about the nursing home or rest home care their loved one is receiving during the COVID-19 outbreak. And again, that number is 617-660-5399, and it's operating 7 days a week. As the governor has noted, the command center has worked to increase testing capacity as quickly as possible to provide access to testing for more residents, and recently opened yesterday the first rapid testing program available to the general public. COVID-19 testing is currently conducted by dozens of private labs, hospitals, and other partners, and the Department of Public Health is working with these organizations to improve the data reporting by race and ethnicity so that we all can better understand where and on whom the burden of disease is falling, so collectively we can respond more effectively. Today's daily report will include race and ethnicity, but a few caveats. The data is current, will be current as of April 5th, and obviously it will be subject to change. The information on race and ethnicity is collected and reported, as I said, by laboratories, healthcare providers, and local boards of health, and may or may not reflect self-reporting by individuals. If no information is provided by any reporter on a case's race or ethnicity, it is classified as missing. A classification of unknown indicates the reporter did not know the race and ethnicity of the individual. The individual may have refused to provide the information, or the originating system did not capture and report the data. I want to be clear. Obtaining racial and ethnic data on cases of COVID-19 is crucial for examining where and on whom the burden of illness and death is falling. It's important, yet it's actually essential for the Commonwealth's response to the pandemic, and important information for all of us to understand. The data on race and ethnicity is far too incomplete in far too many cases. We are taking steps to improve the submission of these key data points. We are issuing an order today requiring that those data fields are to be completed so that we can begin publicly reporting on these measures as we do on virtually every other public health condition. Thank you, Governor.
Questions? So I think we all are appalled by what took place at the Holyoke Soldiers Home, and especially about the lack of follow-through on standard protocols with respect to reporting, which is the reason why we brought in former first assistant to the U.S. attorney here in Massachusetts, Mark Perlstein, to do an independent investigation. Obviously, the attorney general has particular oversight responsibilities, and we welcome her. We welcome her review. The other thing I would say is that since we were notified two Sundays ago at about 9 o'clock at night about the situation there, we moved quickly to install a new management team and a command center at the site the following morning, and since then have tested all residents, all employees, and have established, with the help of Holyoke Medical Center, a COVID facility for many of the residents who tested positive at Holyoke Soldiers Home, and continue to pursue reforms with respect to care, isolation, and infectious disease control.
Uh,
This is Radio Boston. You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's coronavirus briefing.
I've had two conversations with Mark Perlstein, and in both of them, I basically said, if you have any problems accessing anyone or any information, tell me. He's in it. Well, obviously, the biggest thing people need to do is to continue to practice the social distancing and the stay-at-home activities that have led to, you know, a 60% reduction in retail and recreation since March 8th in Massachusetts, and a 75% reduction in mobility associated with public transit, and a 63% reduction in park activity. I mean, the most important thing people need to do here is to recognize and understand that they need to stay away to the fullest extent possible from other people. And to the extent they can stay at home, that's great. To the extent they can work from home, that's great. If they have to go to work because they're part of an essential part of our economy and have been deemed as such, we expect them to be able to implement the same social distancing standards and the same hygiene standards, wherever it is they work, that the rest of us are implementing. But that's the biggest thing people can do. With respect to our planning generally around the surge, I've said many times that we are dealing with an unprecedented virus here. And all we know about the future of this is really what we've seen in other places. And how it plays out in other places comes with a whole variety of variables. But we've tried pretty hard to take what we've seen in Wuhan, what we saw in Lombardy, and what we see in New York, and incorporate it into our own modeling, as well as looking at many of the other models that have been developed that are available for public review. But every time we've talked about our modeling, we've always said, at this time. And the reason we say that is because things change as this changes. But I can say that based on our modeling and a lot of the other modeling we've seen that involves either similar circumstances to ours or states like ours, people anticipate that sometime between April 10th and April 20th is when we can expect to see the surge. And that's why we've put literally thousands of additional step-down medical field facility beds up across the Commonwealth, and almost 1,000 COVID-19 skilled nursing facility beds up as well. And it's why we've been recruiting both retired medical professionals and medical students who've just graduated from medical school, and nursing students, and a whole series of other folks who have either a direct or a significant connection to the healthcare community to come work with us and with our existing healthcare system. And it's part of the reason why we talk almost every morning to most of the major healthcare systems in Massachusetts, to get a sense from them about what they are seeing in their institutions on the ground and what they're hearing from their clinicians. Yeah.
So let me, great. So in terms of reporting, and I actually looked at the form myself because I'm that kind of a person. So the form is very clear about the data elements that are to be included for testing. The only thing you have to submit historically is sort of your name and date of birth. Although it says race and ethnicity, so it's not, it's, the form says, please submit, and we're changing please submit to it's required with a public health order today. Yes.
And then the MAVEN system?
Right. So the MAVEN system, as you know, is our sort of system of truth in Massachusetts. It's actually very robust. In terms of data, what happened and why we had that large number of deaths reported on Monday, it actually is not the MAVEN system. It's our vital record system, which we have been trying to update for a significant period of time, and it's actually part of what we had filed in the governor's budget was a significant upgrade of the vital record system. And so what happened that there was no feed on weekends from vital records into the Maven system. So this is not a Maven system problem. It was a vital records exchange of data from vital records, which a significant part of our vital record system in Massachusetts continues to be a paper system. So that was where that sort of disconnect happened. We have now, that's now automated, so come this weekend, that will not be an issue.
So you don't see any changes needed to the Maven?
So the Maven system, from what everyone reports to me, is a very good system of truth for all of our surveillance data.
Can I say one other thing about the Maven system, which I think is important? When we first started talking to Partners in Health about creating a very big and very broad, somewhat unprecedented contact tracing program, we spent a lot of time talking to our technology people and their technology people about whether or not Maven would have the capacity to deal with literally 1,000 or 2,000 contact tracers working out there, collecting data on potentially as many as 500,000 people. And the answer that our technology people gave to the tech people at Partners in Health was that Maven was robust enough to play really big in this space. So I definitely don't think Maven is going to be our issue with respect to our ability to collect data.
This is WBUR. You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing from the State House.
The only thing I would say about the numbers is no one should draw broad conclusions on 1 day or 2 days or 3 days or 4 days. What I do think I can say about the numbers is when you start at the beginning of this process, part of the reason why it appears you double quickly or you increase by 5 times quickly in terms of the number of cases you have is because you're working off a really small base. The higher up you get, the bigger absolute number you have to generate to create that doubling effect. And if you just look at the last 10 days, it's been somewhere between 650 and 1,350 new cases each day. And that just means if it stays in that general vicinity, then over time, you will actually see a little bit of a bend of the curve. But the other thing I've also said, and we continue to believe, is you can't draw broad conclusions from a few days' worth of data in this space. I do think the fact, as I said in my remarks, that we've seen a fairly significant increase in the number of people testing positive, even as we've significantly increased our testing, does imply that, in fact, we are continuing to grow the number of people who here in the Commonwealth are infected. And that is why we're building surge capacity and assuming that at some point in the not-too-distant future, we and the Commonwealth of Mass and our healthcare community are going to be dealing with it. So in the middle of an economic downturn where 25%, where the report that was issued today that said as many as 25% of our working population could be out of work, we should raise taxes? I don't think so. Say again? Yeah. Total transparency. Do you want to speak to that one?
So we put out the data. We have the data that shows by region, by type of whether it's hospital, nursing home, EMS, police, fire, and the like. Happy to make that data available to you so you can see Western Mass. I actually check it. I get calls from somebody saying so-and-so hospital. Actually, I get calls from legislators. So-and-so hospital did not get their PPE allotment, and I can sort of look it up and say, nope, on 4-4, 1,800 masks were sent out. So if there's a specific question about a hospital.
Are you going to do some work to say, how do you know
So the Springfield Police Department received 1,800. Springfield received 1,800 masks on the last day of March. What they are requesting is N95s, which are not in compliance with the CDC guidance, and the PPE that we submit, that we distribute out, is in compliance with the CDC guidance, which is online on our website.
Are you noticing any hot spots in Massachusetts, areas that we're getting a lot more than other places? How do you intend to prioritize services?
So hot spots in terms of PPE distribution or hot spots in terms of? Yeah, so there's no question that Berkshire Pittsfield was an early hotspot for Massachusetts. That was, as we've said before, that was an area of community spread that we could not, you could not tie to someone who had Biogen or foreign travel. In fact, today's Wednesday. Okay, sorry. So yesterday we actually stood up a shelter in Pittsfield with tents and the like to help deal with individuals who are housing insecure or homeless, as a way to sort of quarantine or isolate. So we're working community by community. I'm using Pittsfield just as an example, because as you know, Berkshire Medical Center, a couple of nursing homes in Western Mass, there's Berkshire County in particular has been a hotspot. But there are, when you look at the maps, we have various communities that are hotspots. Chelsea and Revere, we're working very closely with Chelsea and Revere and the mayor and the city manager of creating sort of a hotel as for isolation for individuals who are COVID-19. Brockton has been a bit of a hot spot. Been working with the mayor again around homelessness and setting up quarantines and the like. And as you know, we have five or six hotels being set up across Massachusetts specifically for people who are housing insecure and homeless who need to be isolated because obviously there's density issues in homeless shelters and the like. So we count everyone who's died who's tested COVID-19, regardless of whether they're hospitalized or not hospitalized and at their and where they have died. So I don't know specifically what the New York Medical Examiner has said, but we're reporting everything that we have available to us.
Go ahead. So we've made pretty clear that we've tried very hard to implement a series of procedures and protocols and standards here in Massachusetts to protect the people of Massachusetts from community spread. We've also said on a number of occasions that significant numbers of the customers who procure cannabis at recreational marijuana dispensaries in Massachusetts are not from Massachusetts because many of the states around us, in fact, I think almost all of them, have not legalized recreational marijuana. Making those sites available to anybody from the Northeast would cut completely against the entire strategy we're trying to pursue here in Massachusetts to keep people safe. And that's why they're not an essential business.
You're listening to WBUR's live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's coronavirus briefing,
which is going to involve trying to save the lives of tens of thousands of people here in Massachusetts. And I really would hope that people in Massachusetts would focus on that, too, because that is, in many respects, going to be our greatest challenge over the next 2 or 3 weeks. So we are trading data with the federal government around ventilators, and it is my hope and my expectation that we will do better on this one by the time we need them. Look, I sit around and I think a lot about the fact that I called every single person I could think of in Massachusetts who had some sort of global connection to something to try to find somebody who could access N95 masks in China. And then I asked our professional football team to actually work with us to come up with a strategy to get the masks back to the U.S. and back to Massachusetts from China. I think a lot of this stuff is a lot harder than it should be. But I've also said before that, you know, at the end of the day, you got to, my parents always said, you know, you play the hand. And we're going to play it as best we can. But it's a tough hand. Yes, we are pursuing ventilators through other strategies as well. No, because what I've always said about this stuff, until it actually arrives, doesn't exist, right? I haven't seen the letter, but we obviously issued some pretty rigorous guidelines. First of all, based on updates and adjustments in federal guidelines around construction, we significantly reduced the number of projects that would be considered essential, basically down to infrastructure, housing, pretty much infrastructure and housing utility work. That was about it. And then we put some pretty aggressive criteria in place with respect to what they needed to do on those sites to keep people safe, and basically said that we would enforce those guidelines ourselves and also talk to our colleagues in local government and said that if they would need our assistance in enforcing guidelines, then we would work with them to do that as well. With respect to some of the other, I haven't seen the letter, so it's hard to comment on the rest of it. What I would say is that generally speaking, our rules and our approach to this have been to rely on the federal guidelines for the most part, and if we have concerns about particular parts of the guidelines, to either not include them in our guidelines or to come up with some strategy that we believe can make them safer. And then we make adjustments. Part of the reason we changed the rules with respect to grocery stores is because we heard from a lot of our colleagues in local government and from local boards of public health that we needed to. And we do know that many communities have chosen to go beyond some of the stuff we've done. Fine. Part of why we made the decision that we made last week to ban parking at all of the state's beaches was because we heard from some of our colleagues in local government who raised legitimate concerns about the fact that people weren't social distancing the way they should have been in those locations. And I also hope the fact that we banned parking at the state beaches gave some local folks who were concerned about their own beaches sort of the overview that they would have needed to go ahead and do the same thing that we did if they felt that would be in the best interest of their communities as well. But I do take some comfort from the fact that if you look at the drop in mobility on those Google reports that get issued that track people's phones, we've had a 60% drop in retail and recreation, a 60% drop, I think 56% drop in park activity, a 45% drop in work activity. I mean, we've had some pretty significant numbers that are much bigger than the U.S. numbers with respect to the drops that we've had in mobility generally, which is a good sign that people are taking this stuff seriously and doing the things they should be doing to stop the spread. So those two things have a lot to do with each other? Just curious. Yeah. The answer to the second one is yes. And I do think all of our COVID-19 stuff is in 12 languages. Okay. If you go to mass.gov/COVID-19, you can pick 12 languages that you want to follow that data in. The UI website, like many of the UI websites around the country, desperately needs an upgrade. And we are working to develop a multilingual capacity on that site. We have also, I give Secretary Raza Costa and her team credit. They've created some pretty good workbooks that make it pretty easy for somebody to rely on one of those workbooks that are in different languages to actually fill out the form, even if the form itself is in English. And the first question, the thing we did with respect to hydroxy, that's not quite right, but the thing we did with respect to that was we adopted the policy that Ohio implemented, which is their Board of Pharmacy took a vote that basically said you could only prescribe it for certain circumstances and certain situations consistent with its medically prescribed use. Isn't that basically right? Thanks, everybody.
This is Tiziana Dearing of Radio Boston. You've been hearing live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing from the State House. The update today contained a couple of key headlines. The first is increasing the liability coverage for healthcare workers, both employed healthcare workers and volunteer healthcare workers, so that they don't have fear of lawsuits while making difficult decisions in the moment. Also, protection in surge preparation, more conversation about N95 masks, and our challenge of getting ventilators from the federal government. Lastly, we heard about surges in a couple of neighborhoods. When asked, the governor said that Chelsea, Revere, and Brockton all seem to be looking like hotspots. And that came in conjunction with the discussion about a new attempt by the Commonwealth to collect race and ethnicity data, which, while challenging, beginning today, we'll be reporting with that race and ethnicity data. We'll be returning you now to All Things Considered, having taken some time for the governor's update. I am Tiziana Dearing from Radio Boston. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston at 3 o'clock.